Hello, this is from our own correspondent with me, Pascal Harter. Today, welcome to a special programme on Australia. The mining boom there has helped the country escape the financial crisis that's been ravaging so many other economies around the world. In fact, it's done much more. Largely thanks to the taxes on the mining industry, the government there has been running a surplus, not a deficit. Economists argue the wealth has trickled down. Australians are now reported to have the highest personal wealth in the world. But Neil Trevithick asks if that has come at a price for the community for whom the value of land can't be calculated in cents and dollars.
I've come to Western Australia to look at the effect of the Chinese demand for natural resources here. The region is booming, and the sites, as well as the facts and figures, defy belief. Constant trains of iron ore trucks, more than 2.5 kilometres long, clank into Dampier Port on the Burrup Peninsula in the Pilbara region, and conveyors pour the earth in a constant stream onto 300,000-tonne bulk carriers day and night. Western Australia drives the Australian economy, but the centres of its boom, the heavily mined Pilbara, and especially the heavily explored and soon to be exploited Kimberley to the north, are among the last great wildernesses. The state as a whole is about a quarter of the size of Europe and has 1.6 million inhabitants, but 1.2 of them live in Perth, the regional capital, which leaves only 600,000 people across the rest of the land. To reach the mines, we drive for hour after hour after hour across emptiness. I watched one of those enormous trains being loaded with ore, but there was nobody there in this vast landscape. Rio Tinto has an office in Perth, 3 hours' flight away, and someone sits at a computer moving a joystick to load the wagons, edging the train forwards a few metres at a time to begin loading the next trucks. It's easy to see how Mad Max crept into popular culture here. Emptiness is what the early settlers saw here, terra nullius. The battles that began as the longest continuous culture on the planet began to appear out of the bush 200 years ago, continue here and now. The Aboriginal population fight constantly for what is called native title over their lands, and thus the right to negotiate with mining companies for some small share in their wealth. Some Aboriginal communities have come into many millions of dollars. Others have nothing. The bitterness that results is lethal. Suicide is the main cause of death for young Aboriginal men here. All this I know by the time I'm standing in Deep Gorge on the Burrup Peninsula, amongst one of the highest concentrations of Aboriginal rock art on the planet. Hundreds of thousands of drawings are etched into the red rocks, covering a period of some 30,000 years. Here is a pre-ice age flat-tailed kangaroo, overlaid with a much, much later drawing of a turtle. In the time that has elapsed between these two works of art, the sea has moved inland by some 10 kilometres, and the diet has changed from meat to seafood. It's 38 degrees at 10 o'clock in the morning, and the sweat from my hands makes the microphone slippery. Water and shade have never seemed so essential to life. A few hundred metres away, a kangaroo as tall as a man looks at us before thumping round a corner of rock. The ground bakes, the flies buzz so loud around my head that I record them as I try to take in artistic endeavour on a geological timescale. Land is the religion of the Aborigine, and I stand under a eucalyptus tree in the midst of the representation of that religion and sweat. On the way out, my guide points to another drawing. "We think that's Dampier's ship," he says. "You can tell it's hundreds of years old by the patina that overlays the scratches." Ships and sailing are my other life, and I pounce on this drawing like a man finding water in the desert. I photograph it, I run my hands over it. William Dampier landed here in 1699 looking for water to take back to his ship, the Roebuck. She was built by Snelgrove's yard at Wapping in London in 1690, launched on April the 17th, 98 feet long, 25 feet beam, 8 guns. On the rock I can see the details of the bowsprit, 2 masts, 4 stays, the angle of the stem and the raised poop at her stern. I think of the crewman scratching this childlike drawing of his ship, so very far from home, and I wonder if he ever returned. Is this the Roebuck? Later, I look up her details on the internet, try and compare them to my digital photographs of the rock. Dampier wrote in his log of seeing smoke rising in the distance from here. But little else. My emotional reaction to seeing what might be the Roebuck drawn on that rock was different to my appreciation of the Aboriginal drawings. And later that evening, I reflect on the sheer amount of cultural baggage I was able to bring to bear on that ship. I've walked Wapping and its docks. I was taught about the reign of William and Mary. I've picked red roof tiles from Henry VII's Tudor Palace off the beach in Greenwich. With my son, I've collected the clay pipes of long-dead sailors from the Thames mud. I explained to him that Deptford Creek used to be the largest shipyard in Europe, and we looked at the statue there of Peter the Great, who came to Deptford in 1698 to learn all about shipbuilding 8 years after the Roebuck was built, and just as William Dampier set out on the voyage that brought him to the place in Australia where I've just been standing. The question of Aboriginal land rights and heritage is a canker in the heart of modern Australia. You can diminish Aboriginal numbers statistically to 2% of the total population, but in the rural northwest, on country as they call it, they're more like 30%. Before the mining boom, this burning vastness was their last line of retreat. But now they've been thrust into the front line of global economics, and the land is being stolen from beneath their feet yet again. What is the value of this unique civilization in comparison with a 30-year mining boom? Mining receipts can be quantified to the dollar of gross national product, currently $110 billion a year. But how does one compare the dollar to the value of a Stone Age culture still walking amongst us? And what could we learn from this culture, for whom taking dreams from the earth is a religion? Back in Perth, I put this question to Colin Barnett, the Premier of Western Australia, who makes all the big decisions granting mining licences, from a government building filled with Aboriginal art. His answer is as follows, and I quote, "I understand the philosophical point you make, but I also understand that someone has to make a decision, and that is a government. After thousands of years of occupancy for the Aborigines, this is the one roll of the dice. This is the critical decision they are making. This is their one opportunity for economic self-determination. There are no villains in this landscape. That's the single truth that comes out of our 30-odd hours of interviews and 3,000 kilometres of often dirt-track driving. But the only way modernity can seem to find of valuing this ancient culture is to throw money at it. Can that really be our only measure of value?" As we leave Deep Gorge, my dry tongue sticks to the roof of my parched mouth. Suddenly a large bird appears in the hard blue sky circling above us, an eagle. It cruises along the escarpment and spins tightly over our heads. Ken, our guiding anthropologist, nods upwards. They would say that he's an ancestor, making sure we haven't damaged the rocks of this sacred site. "But," I reply, "your post-Enlightenment white fella would say that you're bound to get birds flying the thermals rising from this outcrop of hot rocks." "Aye," grins Ken. "But why would he show up now, at this moment, just as we leave?"
Neil Trevithick, unpacking his cultural baggage in Australia.